Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is on lightning. Did you know there are support groups for people who've been struck? The record holder was struck 7 times. But first, there are reports today that the U.S. is considering opening an office, a quasi-embassy, in Tehran, which would mean a return of U.S. diplomats to Iran for the first time since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Also today, the Iranian foreign minister is welcoming the U.S. decision to send its third ranking diplomat to Geneva tomorrow to attend talks with Iran. Undersecretary of State William Burns will be listening, not directly negotiating, but it will be the first high-level diplomatic contact with Iran since the Iranian Revolution. Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, is in Tehran. Borzu, the immediate goal of the talks tomorrow is a temporary freeze on Iran's uranium enrichment and, in return, a freeze on any new sanctions against Iran. But how high are hopes that there could be some kind of breakthrough tomorrow, or is the fact that they're even meeting seen as the breakthrough?
I think that is somewhat of a milestone. Let's be cautious here. William Burns, the number three at the U.S. State Department, is not going to talk to the Iranians. He's going as an observer. And according to the Western diplomats that I talked to in Europe and in Tehran, part of the reason they want him to come is they want the U.S. to see for themselves, look, this is what we're up against. We're up against pretty intransigent, ideologically hardline group of people when we're at the negotiating table. You keep asking us, what are they saying? What are they saying? Why don't you come and see what we're up against? There is a proposal out there that you referred to. It's called Freeze for Freeze, a period of so-called pre-negotiations under which Iran would agree to stop adding new uranium-producing machines, and the U.S. and the West would stop pushing for new sanctions for a six-week period. Now, it is my understanding, talking to diplomats here in Tehran, that the Iranians like this idea, but they want it for longer. But the Americans see this as a delaying tactic.
Well, you talk about the negotiators being up against hardliners at the table tomorrow. We're also hearing, though, that Iran's foreign minister received a letter from Condoleezza Rice that apparently broke the ice here and was stunned to see that she'd actually signed it. And that sort of diplomatic gesture was what softened him going into the talks tomorrow. You know, is there a chance that some of that intransigence is breaking down?
Again, I would caution against being too hopeful. Condoleezza Rice's signature was on a piece of paper that was submitted a month and a half ago among 5 other signatures of European and world powers. And anyone who understands Iran knows that the foreign ministry here is not exactly the most powerful institution when it comes to foreign policy, and that Manuchehr Motaki, the Iranian foreign minister, is a fairly decent, moderate figure in the Iranian political constellation.
Well, Motaki is also the one today saying that this proposed U.S. office in Tehran would be a U.S. interest protection bureau. He's insisting it would not be an embassy. But what more do we know about this proposal of the U.S. returning to Tehran for the first time since 1979?
Well, the U.S. does have an interest section here in Tehran. It is a small office run by Swiss officials. What they're talking about is removing it from the auspices of the Swiss embassy and expanding it possibly by adding U.S. officials here, U.S. consular, or maybe even diplomatic officials. That is something that has been whispered about in Washington. That would be a very interesting thing if it were to happen. It would give the Americans an eye on the ground here, a better sense of what's going on here.
Yeah. And by the way, you there on the ground in Tehran, how are all of these things, the talks this weekend, the talk of a new office, diplomatic moves, how is it being perceived by the average Iranian?
Well, Robin, I mean, at this point, the average Iranian, you know, there's a huge economic crisis globally. It's hitting especially hard in the Middle East. I am shocked. I've not been here for 7 months, and I noticed that the price of everything has doubled. You know, I used to get lunch for $6, just a little fast food joint down the street. It's now $12 or $13. gasoline has doubled, taxis have doubled, everything has gotten really expensive. So people here are just bewildered by the economic change and the inflation, and that is really on the minds of a lot of people. It's causing a lot of discontent. However, Iranians are increasingly nationalistic, and the Iranian leadership has managed very effectively to link the nuclear issue to Iran's sense of national pride.
Even though the isolation it's causing is causing them economic hardship.
Yeah, absolutely.
Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Tehran. Borzu, thanks as always.
It's been a pleasure.
Thunder and lightning. I remember a thunderclap in Thailand so strong it knocked my earrings off. Once in Montana, I saw lightning hit a tree and set it aflame. July is the peak month for lightning strikes. 5 young people were struck and killed in 4 days, the week of the 4th, riding a bike in Colorado, in a watercraft in South Carolina, on a farm in Wisconsin, in a beach hut in North Carolina. Last Wednesday here in Massachusetts, lightning caused 2 simultaneous fires in the town of Wellesley, in one case after hitting an air conditioner. The U.S. had 45 deaths from lightning last year and at least 16 so far this year. But did you know that lightning is responsible for more than 10,000 fires in the U.S. annually and causes an estimated $5 billion in damage every year? That's just one fact in a fascinating new book, Out of the Blue, A History of Lightning, Science, Superstition, and Amazing Stories of Survival. Author John Friedman joins us from the NPR studios in New York. John, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, what is lightning?
Lightning is a powerful electrostatic discharge that occurs in the Earth's atmosphere as well as on Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn. Scientists, though, really are not exactly sure what causes lightning. One theory is that droplets of rain and ice become electrically polarized as they fall through the atmosphere's natural electric field. Another theory suggests that colliding ice particles become charged by electrostatic induction as they are in the atmosphere.
Huh. And who knew there are so many stories related to lightning? In 1228, Thomas Aquinas, when he was a child, lightning struck the tower where he was sleeping. He was spared. It killed a sister. Can you just tiptoe a little bit through history and remind us of the different ways that lightning was viewed? You know, as you write, the ancients thought it was magic from the sky. But even Socrates talked about it, and, you know, it's in the New Testament.
Exactly. Probably the earliest depiction of lightning occurs in Western Australia, where about 20,000 years ago, prehistoric rock engravings show a figure with his hair standing on end. This is the state that occurs right before a lightning flash happens, when the hair in one's arms or one's hair will stand up a little bit. Every society, every culture has had a lightning deity. The Chinese told of Lutsu, the god of thunder. The ancient Vedic books of India described Indra, who carried thunderbolts on his chariot. The Mayans worshipped Apeku, the Irish, the Polynesians. They all had lightning deities.
Greek mythology had Zeus, of course, who used lightning to punish. As I mentioned, the New Testament, lightning usually meant a revelation. But tell us about the time in the 1700s when there were medieval religious attitudes toward lightning, that it was punishment from God. And if you rang church bells, you could ward it off.
There was a belief in the Middle Ages that if you had church bells ringing during a thunderstorm, that lightning would not strike the church or the surrounding buildings. Unfortunately, many of the church bell ringers themselves were struck.
I mean, I don't mean to laugh because it's just terrible, but I'm looking at the book that was published in Germany, Proof that the Ringing of Bells During Thunderstorms May Be More Dangerous Than Useful.
Well, it's interesting that in 1786, the Parliament of Paris issued an edict prohibiting bell ringing during storms. But as late as 1824, 4 new bells were, quotes, baptized against lightning and placed in the Cathedral of Versailles while government officials took part in the ceremony.
I mentioned the Catholic intellectual St. Thomas Aquinas. Martin Luther had an encounter with lightning?
Yes, he did. Luther was, at the time, a young German law student. And in 1505, while traveling to visit his parents in early July, there was a severe thunderstorm that surprised him. Lightning struck very nearby, perhaps throwing him to the ground. And at the time, in fear of death, he called out to St. Anne, who was his father's patron saint, with the rather surprising news, "I will become a monk." 2 weeks later, Luther honored this promise and entered the mendicant order of Augustinian monks.
And went on to invent Protestantism.
Exactly.
You know, we can trace Protestantism perhaps back to lightning. It's just remarkable. I want to continue with the history, but in modern day, you met so many people who also had the same experience. Their lives were changed by lightning. Tell us some of the people who were hit by lightning and how it affected them.
Well, the interesting thing, Robin, is that a number of people have been hit many times by lightning. I interviewed, for example, a man in Oklahoma City who was struck 6 times, and he has no ill effects from any of the strikes. I asked him if anything bothers him, and he smiled and he said, "Well, my knees are kind of weak, but I don't think that's due to lightning."
Well, but then others have been killed, but terribly affected physically.
That's absolutely true. One of the things about lightning is that it's so hard to predict what effect it's going to have on its victims. Some people walk away without any injuries. Some people are crippled for life. Some people lose their memory. I interviewed in person and in depth about 25 survivors. What I noticed was that nearly all of them felt that they had been saved by God for some purpose, but they didn't know exactly what the purpose was. However, they all seemed to be better people in the sense that they were more generous, more unselfish, more caring of others.
You meet many of these in a lightning support group, people who gather together to talk about this experience because it's so unique. What is it about being struck by lightning that people tell you? And again, every experience is different. But what is it? Is it they felt an electric field or that they saw angels when they were out?
The experiences vary from a mountain climber who was on the Grand Teton several years ago, who sensed a buzzing in the air as if a swarm of insects were present right before he was struck. On the other hand, many people are struck out of the clear blue, have no warning. They're just completely surprised that lightning decided to hit them.
Well, and why does it hit one person, and in some cases, not the person standing right next to them? You have several accounts, a father holding a child, the father killed the child fine, a family of three in 2004 walking down the steps at the University of Florida, Pensacola, all are hit, all three knocked unconscious, the daughter goes into a coma. This is part of what these survivors grapple with. Why me and not the person standing right next to me?
This is something that is still perplexing scientists. People just don't know. But you mentioned the case of the young woman. She was struck and to this day suffers terribly. She has trouble speaking. She has trouble remembering. She's in pain. Her parents escaped with barely any injuries.
So, what to do to protect yourself? Lightning can strike miles from the cloud it originates in, those bolts from the blue that John just mentioned. Houses are safe because lightning travels down the plumbing and wiring, but that's why bathtubs and phones aren't safe. John Friedman is author of Out of the Blue, as we listen to Cloudburst from Groffet's Grand Canyon Suite. Did you know that if you're mountain climbing, you should remove any ropes because lightning can travel across the rope, especially if it's wet? We're going to hear much more from John. Later today, Nelson Mandela at 90. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from John Friedman, author of Out of the Blue, which looks at the history, science, and superstition around the mysterious phenomenon of lightning. Did you know, for example, that a typical lightning flash lasts less than half a second, but in that time, it can release about 250 kilowatt hours of energy, as Friedman writes, enough to power a 100-watt light bulb for more than 3 months. And as we heard before the break, there are a number of people who have been struck by lightning many times. Roy Sullivan was a forest ranger. He was struck at least 7 times. It hit his toenail, set his hair on fire. No one knows why, but he killed himself at the age of 71. John Friedman, we know people can be struck while on the phone because lightning travels through land-based telephone lines during storms, but is lightning also thought to be conducted through cell phones or iPods?
there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that seems that lightning is conducted through cell phones and iPods. However, the medical profession, and there are only about half a dozen medical specialists in the world who are experts in lightning medicine, tend to discount this.
And yet there's that one case you write about, a runner, lightning storms going on, so he takes refuge, and he's got the iPod earbuds in his ears with the wires coming down his chest. And isn't that where there was the burn mark down the wire?
Absolutely. And again, the medical profession says, well, this is a very isolated case. He might have been struck even if he did not have an iPod on. And I think research, a lot of research is still necessary to find out what actually happens in such cases.
This is one of the problems, too, that you write about, that there is so little known medically about lightning strikes. People believe, for instance, that someone who's struck by lightning shouldn't be touched because they're a conveyor of electricity. Is that true?
No, that's a myth. And unfortunately, many people have suffered after they've been struck because people around them are afraid to touch them. But there is no harm in touching someone who's been struck.
What do we know about who gets struck? There are other people who seem to be struck many times. And by the way, some of them told you they feel there's something inside them. One woman even said, I set off metal detectors in airports after her first strike. She believes that there's something from that first strike that's still in her. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I interviewed a number of people who said that as a result of the strike, they affect electronic devices. For example, one man said that he cannot use computers because every time he sits down at the keyboard and starts the computer, it freezes. A woman told me that she used to be a motorcycle instructor. Now when she rides her motorcycle down the streets, traffic lights, street lights start going on and off.
Some people who have been struck, too, tell you that they feel as if they're very clear about it. Again, every case is different, but they're very clear. It hit me in my right thumb and went straight through me to my left toe. Do we know how lightning goes through us?
Well, it seems to follow the path of least resistance, and usually lightning goes on the surface of the skin because that's where the moisture is, that's where the perspiration might be, and very often the burns that occur from the intense heat.
There were so many women, I noticed, at their kitchen sink with windows in front of the kitchen sink. We can picture that, you know, cutting up a potato or something. Struck standing there at the kitchen sink. And one woman said to you that she'd had a bad leg from an accident before the strike, and afterwards her leg improved.
Yeah, she was a woman I interviewed in Florida who had a couple of metal plates in her leg. She had been struck once. She was struck a second time. And in a very strange occurrence, she said that she used to have difficulty walking before the second strike. After she was struck again, she had no problem walking at all. She says this is a miracle. And such instances are rare, but they have been reported.
Which brings us back to sort of the religious nature of lightning. We're reminded that when Ben Franklin invented the lightning rod, you know, he attached a rod to a roof and he conducted electricity to the ground. And you quote a religious figure saying, it was as impious to ward off heaven's lightning as a child warding off the chastening rod of his father. And it became part of a very big spiritual discussion. Ben Franklin said he didn't think, you know, God really cared about micromanaging people's lives through striking them with lightning. With the people who are struck today, is it still part of a religious discussion for them?
Very much so. Many of the people who have been hit today believe that they have been spared by God, and they become much more religious. They turn to their faith. And interestingly enough, some people have even been struck while working at a church or working in some church group.
How can ordinary Americans today best protect themselves from being hit by lightning?
Well, experts say that the 30-30 rule is the best way to protect yourself. The 30-30 rule says that after you see lightning, count the time until you hear thunder. If 30 seconds pass or less, take shelter immediately. Then, after the last lightning strike that you see, wait at least 30 minutes before going outside.
Huh.
And the best place to take shelter is in an automobile.
There's just so much here. Someone's more likely to be hit on a weekend summer afternoon standing under a tree or boating or golfing. The greatest risk is Lightning Alley from Tampa on Florida's west coast to Titusville on its east. Many cases of Boy Scouts being killed.
Many of these scouts were out camping. They were in the mountains, so they were natural targets.
Let's stick with scouting and camping. Should you go under a tent if it's got a metal pole?
It's better not to. It's better to stay very close to the ground. Experts used to say that a crouching position was the safest. Now they're not so sure. But the point is, stay away from all metal objects and stay away, of course, from high objects.
Like a
tree.
Exactly. Yes, everybody goes under a tree, and that's exactly where they get struck.
I wanted to add that the most dangerous place to be in the United States is in Lightning Alley, which you talked about in Florida, in July on a golf course. Most of the accidents occur in the summer months, and they usually occur in the late afternoon.
Note to myself, no golfing in July in Florida. John Freeman, the book is Out of the Blue, A History of Lightning, Science, Superstition, Amazing Stories of Survival. And they are just amazing stories and amazing history. Thanks so much for compiling it.
Thank you for having me.
Majestic and frightening. Well, next week on Here and Now, we'll hear the newest techniques the candidates are using to find voters, including facial recognition software that monitors your expression at campaign events. That's next week. Still ahead, unless you're grounded by lightning, a new program that lets you cruise through airport security in about 5 minutes. After the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Pakistan, a two-week plunge in the stock market has wiped out many life savings and provoked street riots in the capital, Islamabad. Inflation is on the rise, and shortages of food and fuel are now common in Pakistan. Share prices are falling amid doubts that the recently elected civilian government can handle the country's growing economic and security problems. While the country's army reported today that it killed 10 Taliban-affiliated militants in Pakistan's northwest, the growing strength of Islamic insurgents operating out of Pakistan has become an urgent problem for U.S. and NATO operations in neighboring Afghanistan. And there are reports this week that the U.S. has been massing troops on Pakistan's border for a possible American attack on al-Qaeda and Taliban bases in Pakistan. Joining us from London, Owen Bennett-Jones, longtime BBC South Asia correspondent. Owen, let's start with the protests over the stock market. We see smashed windows, fires in front of Pakistan's stock exchange. What are they protesting?
Well, they're upset because, as you say, savings have been lost. And to be honest, under General Musharraf, whatever else you say about him, the economy did pretty well. I mean, not least because the United States provided what is often said to be $10 billion to Pakistan. In fact, I think closer to $20 billion once all the covert funds are taken into account. So there was economic growth consistently through his period in power. Of course, he's still in office, not really in power anymore.
Well, how much is the three-month-old new civilian government being blamed for the stock market crash?
Well, of course, there will be. And, you know, the fact is that there is disillusionment with this government. It came in with high hopes. People had had enough of Musharraf. They had had enough of military government. They were hoping for something new. What they've got is a muddle, and they don't like it.
The government is the leading party, the party of slain Pakistani leader Benazir Bhutto. There's a junior partner in the government, and they've been squabbling. What are they fighting over?
It's complicated, and I won't go into the whole details, but basically you've got the widower of Benazir Bhutto. He doesn't want these judges restored. Basically, he's afraid that if these judges who have been sacked by Musharraf, if they're restored, that they would go for him on corruption. So he doesn't want to do it. And Nawaz Sharif, his big rival stroke colleague in this coalition government, is saying, no, they must be restored. And that is the sort of fundamental issue that is undermining the coalition government.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, how is the coalition government seen as handling insurgents? When the government came to power, it made a big point of announcing it would negotiate with Islamic militants rather than fight them. Today, Pakistan's army announces that it's killed militants. What is the truth about how the new Pakistan government is dealing with insurgencies traveling from Pakistan to Afghanistan?
Here's the deal. Here's what happened. When they came in, they said, we've got to have talks because this American idea of coming over and bombing them with all the obvious civilian casualties just doesn't work. We've got to talk. So they talked, and they gave the militants everything. They just gave them everything. And so then the Americans are saying, what are you doing? And the militants are saying, great, we'll take all your concessions, in return for which they are meant to stop fighting. And it has carried on fighting. So then the Americans are saying, what on earth is going on? You cannot do this. And we will, as you talked about troops massing on the border, we will act if you don't. So now you've got the army saying, no, we're acting, we're dealing with it. So it's a total mess.
Well, the London Times is reporting that U.S. troops and equipment have been massing on the Afghan side of the border. A Pakistan official says that's probably routine movement. It's the media creating hype. What do you know?
What I know unofficially is that the Americans have had enough. They think that al-Qaeda is strong in the tribal areas, that it has to be dealt with, that Musharraf is not showing enough urgency, Pakistan isn't taking it seriously enough, and therefore they're saying, if you don't act, we will.
Well, the same London Times piece says that U.S. Admiral Mullen traveled to Pakistan a few days ago and pretty much laid down the law, warned leaders of possible unilateral U.S. military action inside the country. There's already been reaction to those reports. You know, what are other sectors in Pakistan saying? I'm thinking, for instance, of tribal leaders on the border.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, my understanding is the deadline for that is 28th of July. Not much time for Pakistan to show action. Well, you know, the fact is, if the Americans go in with ground troops, it will be a disaster because it will unify the tribes against America. So the current strategy that's been used in Iraq and to some extent in Pakistan, where they pay off tribal leaders, try and create splits between the Taliban and al-Qaeda, try and create splits between Pakistan Taliban and Afghan Taliban, that's how you have to do it. It's difficult, it's complicated, it requires consistency and it requires time, but it works. Putting in troops is obviously going to backfire. No Pakistani will accept having American troops on their territory. But, you know, patience is running out in Washington, so there is a crisis coming, and it looks like it's in the next few weeks.
Well, and there's already been a crisis in that the Taliban in Afghanistan has grown so strong that it could mount that recent attack on a U.S. base, killing 9 U.S. troops. U.S. and Afghan military have abandoned that base. What is your sense of what's going to happen now on two fronts? We talked about the economic problems in Pakistan and the protests, the violent protests against the, you know, what's happening in the economy and the security issues. What's your sense of what's going to happen?
The economics won't drive this. I mean, the economics are there. They're bad. You know, the military made various mess-ups with not sorting out electricity supplies and so on. So there is a basic disgruntlement there. But that is not going to drive this. It is the security situation on the border that is the driver. And what you've got, as you say, is a strong and growing, increasingly strong Afghan Taliban. You've got Pakistani Taliban who see themselves as brethren, ethnic brethren, religious brethren of those people and who want to fight in support of them against what they see as an American NATO occupation. So, you know, that's not going to go away. It's just how you deal with it. And at the moment, the Americans are saying, you're not being strong enough, Pakistan. You're not doing enough to deal with it. I mean, I can see what they're saying. I mean, some of these madrasas haven't even been closed down yet after all these years. You know, the Americans have a point, but it's just a question of how they respond to their frustration.
The madrasas, the Islamic fundamentalist schools. Well, just meantime, a quick point. Today, U.S. and Iraqi officials announced that they are talking about, you know, a possible timetable for withdrawal of troops from Iraq. Is there a sense that those troops, that those U.S. troops in Iraq are going to go sooner rather than later to Afghanistan? And if so, how will Pakistan view that? Is it sort of, you know, better U.S. troops on that side of the border than on our side?
The thing is that the Americans and the Brits have said to Pakistan for 4 or 5 years now, we are so committed to Afghanistan that we will send as many troops as is required for decades, literally for decades. And there is nobody in Islamabad who believes them. They just think that the Afghan Taliban are going to win. And therefore, it is crazy for them to be fighting the Pakistan Taliban, closely at eye as they are with the Afghan Taliban, and to create enemies of the future rulers of Afghanistan, or at least people who will have a share in power in Afghanistan. So they just don't believe this commitment. Now, the Americans are still in with it, and the Brits are still in with it, and they're still saying, you know, we're serious about this. But, you know, no one in Pakistan, you cannot persuade anybody in Pakistan that there will be NATO, American, British troops in Afghanistan in 10 years' time.
Huh. So why should they gamble on fighting the Taliban in Pakistan today?
Right.
Owen Bennett-Jones, of course, of the BBC, is speaking to us from their studios in London. Owen, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
And this note, Associated Press is reporting today that jihadi fighters from Turkey, Central Asia, Chechnya, and the Middle East are traveling to Afghanistan. Another sign, says the AP, that al-Qaeda is regrouping. More foreigners are infiltrating Afghanistan because of a recruitment drive by al-Qaeda. The growing insurgency of the Taliban has also weakened border security, allowing recruits to get into the country more easily. For the past 2 months, Afghanistan has passed Iraq in the number of deaths of U.S. and allied troops. Well, before we go today, Nelson Mandela turns 90 with her moments from his storied past, including his impassioned speech at his own trial. You're listening to Here and Now. A new priority airport security system, much talked about post-9/11, is now a reality. It's called the ClearFast Pass. It uses fingerprints and eye scanners to speed passengers through the airport, from the ticket counter to the plane in a matter of 20 to 25 minutes. Well, for more on this, we're joined by Khalil Sakakini of TravelVideoPostcard.com. Khalil, 19 airports are using this program. Tell us how it works.
It's a registered traveler program, Robin, that uses biometric information to pre-screen passengers and allow them to go through security in a separate lane. Now, what it does, it really gets you through to your gate in 5 or fewer minutes. And using biometric information stored on a clear plastic card that looks no different from, let's say, a credit card.
Okay, 5 minutes as opposed to the hour you can sometimes wait in a security line.
Absolutely.
So how do people sign up for it?
Right. It's a two-step process. The first thing, you have to go to the website, which is flyclear.com. You go to the website, they ask you a bunch of questions, your age, where you live, and lots of ID questions. Then you put your credit card to them, and they charge you $128 pending your next stage approval, which is then you go to one of their stations, which is in one of the airports where they exist and operate, or let's say Grand Central Station in New York or the American Express office in Washington, D.C. Then you get your irises scanned, your fingerprints taken. All that data is sent to Washington, where you go through a threat assessment process by the TSA. At the end of that process, they will charge your credit card $128. If you pass, you get your clear card, and you go through a separate line handheld by clear employees.
Okay, so the TSA does the screening.
They do the screening.
So the separate lane where you just use the card,
right,
and it shows your identity and you go through. Do you have to prove that? I mean, is there anything you have to do to prove that that's you with the card?
That should be it. I mean, basically, all the information, you have your boarding pass, but when you go to the airport, you see the massive line for everybody else. You see the clear line for you because you have the clear card. You go through that line, an employee is there. They check the clear card that you're holding, look at your boarding pass. You go through security, but you go through security handheld by them. And the assumption is the TSA has vetted you. You're right. Done with all that, you're there.
Yeah, so you don't have to walk through the metal detector, yeah. You don't have to take off your shoes, you don't put your stuff on a conveyor belt, you just go.
You do have to go through the taking off of the shoes, you have to go through putting a laptop, but you're in a line with,
right,
50 people, 10 separate people, 12 people, a separate line.
So I guess the system depends on the TSA to know who does or doesn't pose a security risk once they've done that screening. What are your concerns?
The real risk, I think anyway, is the invasion or potential invasion of privacy. I mean, now the government has all this biometric information, your fingerprints, your irises.
We also know that credit card companies, for instance, even banks, have lost information. Data's been lost. Laptops have been stolen. So all of this information is going to be stored somewhere.
Absolutely.
And someone will have it.
The Verified Identity Pass company in New York, which runs the CLEAR program, they affirm very passionately that privacy will never be violated. They have independent audits. They post the results of the audits on their website. But I don't know.
Do you think that, maybe places like ballparks will start saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we ought to check people's security before they get in, if there's a system where they can do that?
I think it will avoid a lot of hassle at major events. You show the clear card, which assumes you've been pre-screened by the TSA. What more does anybody want? Come on in. You're a first-class citizen. Welcome. You don't have to go through what everybody else has to go through because you've already been checked out.
Right. We know there's another program being tested that allows people to check in at airports with their cell phones. What's What's that?
That's really kind of fun. I mean, it's new. I mean, a handful of airports are using it. You have to have a web-enabled cell phone or handheld device. So when you go to the security gate, you just open your phone, show them the picture of your barcode in the phone, and that's all you need. It's an absolute paperless way of traveling.
Well, but there's some way of assuring that the person who is holding the phone owns the phone.
Yes, you have to show a piece of identification, right. But you don't need to print out your boarding pass. Flip the phone open, show it, you're done.
Khalil Sakakini of TravelVideoPostcard.com. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Okay, and in just 1 minute, a reminder of why we celebrate Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday today. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
I remember when I arrived in Johannesburg, the fear of the power of the white man inhibited us a great deal, and the government was becoming very tough.
Nelson Mandela, as his biographer says, perhaps the closest thing the world has to a secular saint, recalling what it was like in the mid-20th century when he began his decades-long fight against the apartheid government in South Africa.
We began to feel that the time had come to actually challenge a power such as the government of South Africa with all its army and police force and jails.
Nelson Mandela would take up other battles for AIDS awareness after his own son died of AIDS, against despotic African leaders. But his legacy will be his role of freedom fighter, prisoner, president, now elder statesman, his lasting iconic image of beatific smile, raised fist, while dancing the dance of the township, the Toy Toy. Mandela celebrates his 90th birthday today. We're marking the occasion with Joe Richman, the creator of the public radio series Radio Diaries. He's produced a new CD on Nelson Mandela's life. It's called Mandela and Audio History. And Joe joins us from the NPR studios in New York City. Welcome.
Thanks. Hi, Robin.
We know that Nelson Mandela was the former leader of the African National Congress. He later became president of South Africa in between, you know, almost three decades in jail. But briefly remind us, who was he when he came to the anti-apartheid struggle? And what was going on in South Africa when he got there?
He was a lawyer, and he soon went on to form with Oliver Tambo the first black law firm in South Africa. But he quickly was part of the youth wing of the ANC. The youth wing was sort of advocating for more mass movement, for kind of a taking the movement to the streets. Mandela particularly advocated for changing to an armed struggle. Up to that point, it had all been a nonviolent struggle. And Mandela led this movement to create what was called Mkhonto weSizwe, the Spear of the Nation, which was the armed wing of the ANC.
Well, things escalated in 1950 after the South African government installed the Group Areas Act. This was a series of segregation laws that established residential and business sections for each race. Members of other races were barred from living, operating businesses, or owning land in these sections. Here's two South Africans that you interviewed for the documentary describing the impact of those laws on their lives.
There was an immorality act so that you couldn't have sexual relations across the color line, race classification, which laid down for all time your color and your category.
Each time you left your home, you had to make sure that you have a little book in your pocket. If you didn't have that piece of paper, some ignorant, stupid youngster in the police force could stop you and demand that you identify yourself. If you couldn't, they locked you up.
Joe Richman, who are we hearing there?
The woman was Helen Suzman, who for a long time was the lone opposition member of parliament in South Africa during the apartheid years. The second man was Dr. Ntato Matlana, who was Mandela's family doctor for a long time and confidant.
Several events took place. There was the Sharpeville Massacre, which was a protest against these laws that we just heard about. Nelson Mandela, as we said, had become a part of the ANC. He was labeled a terrorist, charged with treason and sabotage. Has he ever said that he killed anyone in the struggle?
You know, at that point, the armed struggle meant something very different than we might think of. It was a movement to bomb iconic establishments of the apartheid regime, past law offices and post offices and power stations. There were no attacks on people. Things would change later in the 80s, But, you know, Mandela in a lot of ways had the good fortune to be in prison for 27 years when a lot of the messiness of South Africa was going on. And through his political life, he was able to keep very clean in that regard.
Well, as we said, he's arrested. It's at his trial that we get our first glimpse of the man who would, you know, become known as a symbol of resistance. In your documentary, you have a recording from part of that trial. Can you just set this up for us?
When they went to trial, they were called the Rivonia defendants, and they all assumed that they would be put to death. So rather than defend themselves, what they decided was to have Mandela make a speech. And he stood up and he began with, "I was born in Umtata," and he went on from there for 4 hours to lay out his vision of a different South Africa.
Let's listen to a little of that.
"I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die."
When people think about this speech now, they think about that one line. In fact, the speech became known as the "I am prepared to die" speech. And it's very much that one line that kind of propelled him into the world's consciousness.
Well, he was convicted and received a life sentence, but that awoke, as you said, the world's consciousness. Protests in the 1980s, a worldwide boycott of South African products, international sanctions against the government that cost the government billions of dollars. I know we're really fast-forwarding here, but finally in 1990, Mandela was released from prison. Oh, a lot of us can remember, you know, getting up at different time zones when that was going to be telecast live. I think it was something like 3 a.m. on the West Coast. Let's listen. You have some archived tape of that moment.
"You join us at the Victor-Verster prison where the excitement is running high. People halfway up trees, standing on their toes, clinging to the wires, trying to get the best possible view. There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, the free man, taking the first step into a new South Africa. Greeting the people, his first public appearance in nearly 3 decades. And one wonders what must be passing through Mr. Mandela's mind at this moment."
Extraordinary moment, watched around the world. What was Mandela thinking, Joe? Do we know?
What's so interesting to think about, you know, hearing those two moments close together, because, you know, you think about if Mandela had been put to death in 1964 in the trial before he went into his life sentence, you know, he would in many ways be sort of a footnote of history, and he would be sort of regarded as, you know, this terrorist and this kind of firebrand. But he wasn't put to death, and 27 years later, he emerged representing something very, very different. And it's interesting to think about how those little small moments of history can have such impact.
He went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993, sharing it with then South African President F.W. de Klerk, the man who released him from prison and who Mandela succeeded as president of South Africa. He could have remained president for life. He stepped down in 1999. He said he wanted to set a precedent for those who followed him. And he's still sort of repeating that message. Just last month, he condemned Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe for not stepping down with all the growing opposition there. Does he still, of course he matters, but does he still have the power in his role?
What he represents now in South Africa, it's, you know, it's hard for me to say as an outsider and only having lived there for a few years, but, you know, he's, of course, the lovable grandfather of the country. I think South Africa is going through so much that in some ways people don't think about history there right now. You know, it's so recent and yet so long ago that this transformation happened. But I think a country is lucky when they have someone to lend some sort of moral authority over the history of its country. You know, Mandela says you can't really be proud of yourself if you don't know your history. And I think for many people, you know, that's exactly what he represents.
Joe Richman, producer of Mandela and Audio History. For more on the CD and Nelson Mandela, who celebrates his 90th birthday today, go to our website, here-now.org. Joe, thanks as always.
Thank you.